Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Federal workers demand end to government shutdown at White House protest. But in last Tuesday's Oval Office address, why didn't the president declare a national emergency? Today's protest, which began at noon in front of the AFL-CIO building on 16th Street Northwest in Washington, which is down the street from the White House, was meant to highlight the struggles of furloughed federal employees and out-of-work contractors. The partial shutdown has left 9 federal departments and several agencies closed since December 22nd. President Trump delivered the first Oval Office address of his presidency this past Tuesday evening, and it came in the midst and was directed to address this protracted partial government shutdown. The president, up until that point, had threatened to declare a national emergency in order to get the money that he claims he needs to build this wall. Why on Tuesday evening, of all the things that he said, did he not declare a national emergency? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my first guest. He is a journalist and columnist. He's been in the business for over 20 years. He is Colin Campbell. Colin, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Hey, thanks, Dr. Leon. It's great to be here.
So before Tuesday evening, the president was threatening. I'm going to declare a national emergency. I'm going to go to the Department of Defense budget. I'm going to take my $5.7 billion, and I'm going to get my wall built. Then Tuesday night, not a mumbling word about national emergency. First question is, why do you think he didn't mention it Tuesday? And do you think that we are days away from him doing so?
Yeah, so let me tackle the first part of your question first. Why he didn't mention it most recently, even though he has been talking about it. I think that the president is very good with understanding what keeps media attention. If we haven't noticed that over the past couple years of covering the president and what news media particularly has been following over the past couple years, it's pretty much the president nonstop. Whatever he's tweeting, whatever he is expressing, whatever people are saying about him. And I think he likes this attention, to say the least. However, I think that he was using the threat of declaring a national emergency as a chip or a way to put pressure on Democratic leadership to come to some sort of a deal as he sees it, without saying that he's going to negotiate for a protracted amount of time. Saying that he would declare a national emergency would allow him to claim some type of ownership over the situation without saying that he had to acquiesce to Democrats. He could say that, listen, we're going to get the wall built. It's going to be done in a different way. The government is going to be back in session again. It won't be shut down anymore. And Democrats still have not won this particular battle. But I do feel that because of the impasse that Democrats have with the president, and I'm leaving out Senate Republicans because right now the leadership is led by Mitch McConnell, who says that he's not going to bring any bills to the floor unless he gets the green light from the president. So really, this is between almost like a battle between House Democrats and the president. And I think that we are becoming a lot closer to the president declaring some type of national emergency. And the reasons for that are because there seems to be too great of an impasse between what the president wants, which is, I'm going to round up the number, $6 billion mm-hmm. in wall funding. The original number is 5.6. Some people say 5.7.
Right.
But we know a project like this, it's probably not going to come under cost, right?
And once you add sales tax.
Yeah. Right, there you go. That's on there. Easily $6 billion.
There you go.
Right?
Sales tax, yeah.
So there we go. So he really wants this funding for this wall, okay? And without it, he's not really willing to negotiate that much more, like we saw this week when he walked out of the meeting. The Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said that he had a tantrum and he walked out of the meeting. Democrats don't want to put up that money.
Right.
Even though the president really wants it, Democrats.
And to be fair, the Republicans said that he didn't. Mike Pence and the crew said, no, he didn't throw a fit. He didn't throw a tantrum. He didn't pound on the table. He didn't yell. He just got up and said, Nancy, I'm done with you. And walked out. So just want to.
That's right. Right. That's okay. Right. Okay. Yes, that is true. Only Schumer characterized him as having a tantrum, I believe. Right. He used the words tantrum. The president himself said, I don't do tantrums.
Right.
I can't remember the exact way he said it, but he said that he doesn't.
That's it.
He doesn't have tantrums, right? But the thing is that the House Democrats want the president to take on a different approach when it comes to border security. Democrats say that they want border security, they just don't want the wall. The president says there can't be border security without the wall, and they can't seem to really come to a negotiating or a bargain agreement on that particular point. Now, Democrats say they want more border security by adding personnel at the border, by securing the ports of entry, because according to statistics and reports, this is where most of the drugs are coming into the country, mm-hmm. are through the ports of entry. They believe that cars should be checked more frequently instead of, I believe the current rate is at 1 out of every 5 cars is thoroughly checked for drugs. They think that it should be more often. They think there should be more technology, drones perhaps, more personnel in the areas where there seems to be a paucity of personnel, of members of the CBP patrolling that area. They believe that there are other methods to secure the border. The president says that, on the contrary, the wall is really what's needed to protect American citizens. He points to MS-13, the gang, I believe from Salvador, that he says is growing in size and is becoming more violent. He points to various murders that have happened at the hands of undocumented immigrants in the country. Mm-hmm. And he says that this wall will really help to prevent those situations. So this is where the impasse is. And I think for the president to really show that he has leadership over this issue, the only thing he could really do is declare a national emergency and say, listen, the wall will be built using different funding. We're going to get the government up and running again. And I'm still going to fulfill my campaign promise to you, even though Mexico wouldn't be paying for it directly. The president will say, listen, through our trade deals,
right,
Mexico is indirectly paying for the wall. We'll get the military to build it, government up and running. I still win, and I'm still a great president.
So here's one of the interesting things to me, and this gets us to the second part of my question. Today, as the president was walking towards Marine One, the helicopter, he didn't do it on Tuesday, but today he threatened to declare a national emergency. He was asked about that and he said, I have the absolute right to declare a national emergency. I'm not prepared to do that yet, but if I have to, I will. If this doesn't work out, probably I will do it. I would almost say definitely. So, to me, it seems as though both sides of this impasse really want him to do that. If he does it, the Democrats take it to court. And it's quite possible that the court winds up shutting it down the same way he did his Muslim ban and some of the other things that he's tried to do. He then can claim to his constituents, I did it, and the court shut me down. The Democrats are then able to say, we held our line against the president. And with that, we can now move to get the government open. So really, if the president does declare a national emergency, both sides are given a way to spin the act into their advantage. Do you see that as possible?
Yeah, I really do. I mean, there's very little doubt that courts would try to intervene to stop the president's reappropriation of power, and because he would probably receive a lot of criticism from federal courts, and they would set up an injunction to stop this from happening. And like you said before, this happened when the president tried to change policy on asylum seekers and those coming from different nations trying to fly in, what some called the Muslim ban. He went through a number of court proceedings for that. And so I believe that would still happen after he declares, if he does declare a national emergency. Of course, Democrats would also like this because it would look like the president is overstepping his bounds. If we look at the precedent of national emergencies, this would not constitute what is traditionally perceived as a national emergency. And it would look like the president is trying to circumvent the constitutionality of what he's trying to achieve, which would then look like he's trying to abridge democracy.
And let's quickly explain why. Quickly, as I see it, and please provide your insight here, this does not fit a national emergency because the military does not have to be called out. There is no domestic insurrection. There is no national catastrophe, i.e. hurricane, earthquake, other type of catastrophe. No one is invading us from foreign shores. So just about any criteria that you would want to use to determine national emergency, even though the president says we have this catastrophe happening at the border, it doesn't really fit the bill. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that is fair to say. I mean, usually it's like a natural disaster, a natural catastrophe, or something with that involves heavy use of the military, like in trying to defend in an act of war or in progress of a war. So this would not really fit that level of an emergency. And I believe that the president has been putting this out here, saying that as a sort of test. As we know, the president is very receptive to polling and the views that how people view him in the public. What is his approval rating at? And I think that throwing that out, saying I could declare a national emergency to get this wall built, what he does is he or his advisors or his aides look at the approval ratings that he usually looks at to see how it rates with the public, how it rates with his base by saying this. And if it looks like they would be more for it or against it, this would be a more viable option for him. But if it seems that the outrage, especially those who he seems to be sensitive to, like the conservative voices such as Rush Limbaugh and Coulter, if they said to him about him that he was trying to usurp undue power, then he would reassess his strategy. But we haven't heard that coming from the voices on the far right, the voices that he listens to, the voices that he decided to change his mind about when there seemed to be passable legislation and how to deal with immigration at the border when he changed his mind. So I think that this is kind of a gauge for him. And so far, he hasn't really been hearing any severe feedback that would try to persuade him otherwise from going another route, like negotiating with Democrats to come to a meeting to find the middle of the road. I think that he's more likely to kind of pick up his ball, go somewhere else and play in another park or another arena, right? Which is what he might be doing by declaring a national emergency.
So here we are. I think today's the 20th day of the shutdown. Today's Thursday. Tomorrow is the first payday that will be missed. But I believe if people have direct deposit, their money was supposed to be in the bank tonight. So you've got folks in the government that aren't getting a paycheck tomorrow. So so if the president were to declare a national emergency tomorrow, and then so the Democrats file an immediate injunction in court, I would say we're still looking at Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday before any possible positive action could be taken. Your thoughts?
That's right, Dr. Leon. And so you said this is we're on the 20th day and people will not get paid on Friday. And the other milestone, of course, is that tomorrow would mark a tie as far as the longest shutdown
correct.
In recent history, right? So
Wait a minute. Real quick. Because that just made me think about this. We haven't heard Newt, because when we talk about the longest in history, Newt Gingrich, I think, holds the record today. So we haven't heard from the eye of Newt.
No, we have not heard from the eye of Newt. He's been pretty quiet. And that's what I mean. These voices that are, you know, from the right that would be pressuring the president, trying to persuade him, have been silent. Senate Republicans have been largely silent. They've been sharply criticized for their seemingly remiss accountability for what's happening. We have, like you said, we haven't heard from Newt Gingrich. And like I said before, we haven't heard from Rush Limbaugh and Coulter criticizing the president for dragging out this shutdown. But if it goes into Saturday, which most likely will, it will be on record as the longest U.S. shutdown. We're only, you know, we're basically hours away from that, for the president setting the record, the dubious record of having the longest U.S. shutdown in history, government shutdown in history. So it's not good for the president. And like you said, even if Democrats were to file an injunction and put through legislation, we're still looking at days away from this shutdown from being over. So this is a very unfortunate situation for 800,000 government workers. But not only that, the places that these government workers patronize.
Yes.
The grocery stores that they go to, the stores that they shop at,
where they have lunch,
goods, the people that where they have lunch, where they buy their groceries for their kids, their families, the services that they may be cutting back on. That could mean a dog walker. That could mean a babysitter. That could mean a whole slew of things.
Getting your car
spend
fixed.
Their money on for their services. Getting their car fixed. Right. Exactly. And all of this. This effect, it'll have a ripple effect on the economy, where people are going to be spending less money, and they're not going to, there won't be this trickle down or this trickle across effect, or multiplier effect rather, of people's money being put back into the U.S. economy.
And here's
so
something too.
We're still days away from that being fixed.
Here's something too to add to that. Small business loans through the SBA, the Small Business Administration. Those loans are not being processed. The farmers who were supposed to get their offset for the soybean debacle with the Chinese, they're not getting their checks. All types of loans and other financial processes that the government is involved in are at a standstill. There are farmers that need reports in order to determine what and where to plant next year. That stuff isn't being given to them. You try to go to the National Weather Service and get a prediction of the weather. The site is down because the government is closed. There are so many practical things that get overlooked if you just try to categorize this as the government is shut down. Folks are really starting to understand how important the government is to their everyday lives.
That's right. And in fact, even if the president was to file a national emergency, Congress would have the power to shut it down within 180 days. So that could even happen. The president still may not get his wall built, even though he has really manufactured this whole debacle that we're in right now.
And it's also wrong for people to think that even if he were granted his money tomorrow, there's eminent domain. Property has to be taken. There are going to be lawsuits in Texas and in Arizona where he wants to build his wall because people don't want their homes and land taken. There's all kind of stuff.
That's
anyway,
right.
Colin
Can you imagine
Campbell.
The Texans with their guns, you know, saying, you're not taking my land.
There you go.
You're not taking my land.
They might really secede from the union then. Colin Campbell.
Yeah.
Thank you always, man. Greatly appreciate you coming on board to the Critical Hour.
Sure thing. Speak to you soon, Dr. Leon.
All right, man. You all are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. So, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo vows to expel every last Iranian boot from Syria. American shame is over. He vows to quell President Obama's Mideast mistakes. Will all this move the United States closer to war with Iran? Why is the U.S. saber-rattling in using such jingoistic language with Tehran? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's a journalist. He's an analyst. He's a voice you hear on this show regularly. It's always a pleasure for me to say welcome, Caleb Maupin, man. Welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. So if you listen to Pompeo, the Middle East has been plunged into chaos and violence because of two entities, Iran and former President Barack Obama. Now he says under President Trump, that's changing. In spite of the fact that Iran, by every measurable and verifiable agency available, was adhering to the Iran nuclear deal, and we seem to be moving closer to better relations with Iran than moving further away. Your thoughts, sir?
Well, if you listen to that speech, you know, on some level, you have to be kind of embarrassed for the United States because, you know, we had an election, a new president was elected, and now we have, you know, Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, going around the world and doing his best to repudiate and drag the previous administration's name through the mud around the world. Now, you understand, you know, partisan mudslinging, that's just part of politics domestically, but it's rare that you would see this being taken to an international level. And the fact that this was delivered in Cairo and the fact that he said this is the real, what does he say? This was the real change of relations. This is the real change. You know, that was dramatic. He's essentially repudiating the Obama administration, saying we're doing things completely differently. And you know, this comes after already the Trump administration has destroyed what the Obama administration thought was its crowning achievement, and that was the Iran nuclear conclusion, the JCPOA, the nuclear deal. That's already been ripped up. So again, what are we exactly seeing here? I mean, this points to a level of division in American politics that is very, very deep. And it's almost as if you know, the fight between Obama and the Republicans seemed to be a fight with different factions around the world on different sides rather than just a fight about what the policy of the United States should be. It is quite shocking to see U.S. leaders taking their internal partisan divisions and bringing the whole world in.
In fact, that was going to be my next question is, I can understand, not necessarily agree, but I can understand President Trump's issues with former President Obama. I got that. But when we get to the international front and the foreign policy front, there has seemed to have been, up until this point, more consistency with American foreign policy than not. And what I see here coming from Pompeo, coming from Bolton, through Trump, is they seem to just be throwing the whole thing, throwing out the baby with the bathwater and forging a new road. Is that naive of me to think, or am I misreading the tea leaves?
I don't think they're necessarily forging a new road completely, but they seem to be really disagreeing specifically about strategy. You know, it's important to note that the Obama presidency, you know, it was very much something that the liberal wing of the American political spectrum would like, not simply in its policies, but even in its imagery, right?
You know, and its rhetoric.
Liberal wing of, yes, the American, you know, the liberal wing of American politics understands that we have a long history of racism in this country. So the election of Barack Obama in many ways was a way domestically to say that we're getting further. We're overcoming some of that ugly history. But it also sent a message internationally, and that's important to remember, because Barack Obama, his middle name was Hussein. He had gone to a Muslim school in Indonesia, and when he took office, it was very much a message to the Middle East that look, here's a guy who's met with the Palestinian scholar Edward Said. He's a guy who had some Islamic education. Here's a guy whose middle name is Hussein, You know, and he's not a Muslim himself. He's a member of a Christian church, but he's more sympathetic to the way you see things. And look, he doesn't get along with Netanyahu. And it was very much a message to the Arab world and to the Muslim world that there was a guy in the White House who was more sympathetic to them and wouldn't be completely hostile. And after the Bush years, when George W. Bush had really, really gone out of his way almost to offend the Muslim world, referring to his fight against terror as a crusade at one point, you know, going against the entire Muslim world and Arab world when he went and unilaterally invaded Iraq, that the Obama administration and the Obama presidency in many ways was seen as an attempt to kind of give an accommodating or more friendly approach to the Arab and Muslim countries of the world. And it seems like now the Trump administration is completely reversing that image and going out of their way to do it, because we all know that the pivotal moment that really kind of opened up that accommodating approach was Obama's speech at American University in Cairo, Egypt. And the fact that Pompeo spoke in Cairo and directly repudiated that speech, I think that really sheds light on things. And I will add that what seems to be interesting is that there seem to be different constituencies in the Middle East. Donald Trump, as much as he criticized them on the campaign trail and criticized Hillary Clinton for her relationship with Saudi Arabia, Donald Trump seems to be very, very friendly to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And it seems like the Obama administration was much friendlier to Turkey, to Qatar, to other forces in the region, but was somewhat, you know, reluctant to be friendly with Saudi Arabia. We saw that, for example, when Michelle Obama visited Saudi Arabia, she did not wear a headscarf and blatantly violated their laws regarding the headdress that women are required to wear. And we saw, you know, occasionally there would be subtle criticisms of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in terms of human rights. And now we see Trump doubling down and defending the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia over the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, and just being very blatant about the fact that we need to keep being allies of theirs, keep selling them weapons, keep getting their oil, and that's that. And this seems to be a pretty clear division. And it's important to note that, you know, after Obama gave his speech in Cairo, you had the Egyptian revolution and the overthrow of Mubarak. You had an election in which the Muslim Brotherhood was elected. Hosni Mubarak, the Muslim Brotherhood was elected. They elected Mohamed Morsi as the president. And then you saw Mohamed Morsi toppled by a military junta, General al-Sisi, coming to power. And General al-Sisi being very hostile to the Muslim Brotherhood and being very close to Saudi Arabia. So the current, you know, government of Egypt, the military government that toppled the Muslim Brotherhood government that was elected in the aftermath of the revolution, is very close to Saudi Arabia. So this division between Saudi Arabia versus the Muslim Brotherhood in the Middle East, it seems to have escalated, right? The Obama administration was very interested in kind of overthrowing governments and utilizing Muslim Brotherhood aligned forces, like in Syria, like in Libya, to fight against governments like Libya, like the Syrian Arab Republic that they didn't like. Whereas the Trump administration seems to really, really be friendly with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and selling the weapons, and with the military that doesn't favor these kind of soft power color revolutions to overthrow governments, but favors the use of military force. So this kind of division, do you use soft power? Do you try to make the image of the United States better around the world? Do you give an accommodating face to the world? Do you do what the intelligence agencies do? Or do you do what the Pentagon likes to do and blow things up and use the mother of all bombs and sell lots of weapons? And do you do, you know, is this the Pentagon versus the CIA? You can view it in that light in a lot of ways, because clearly this attitude that the Obama administration had, that we're going to be friendly, we're going to present an accommodating image to the rest of the world, that seems to have thawed. The Trump administration has no interest in that. Instead, they push the slogan, peace through strength. They don't care if the rest of the world likes us, just so long as the rest of the world is terrified of us.
Does it stand out to you that President Obama gave his speech in Cairo at Cairo University, which I believe is a public institution, where Pompeo gave his remarks at the American University of Cairo, which is a private institution?
Well, I think one could read into that in terms of Egyptian politics. We know that the Egyptian educational system was vastly expanded and basically built by the Egyptian military when they had the leadership of Gamal Abdel Nasser, the Arab socialist leader who took power in the 1950s. And he used the military to vastly expand the public education system in Egypt. And that's why Abdel Nasser is still widely loved in Egypt. I mean, a lot of Egyptians have his face on their wall. And he's just considered to be almost like the founding father. You know, he's on the level of like the George Washington or Abraham Lincoln or Roosevelt or something like that. He's, you know, the guy who created modern Egypt is Abdel Nasser, the military leader who took power and in the name of Arab socialism, built lots of power plants. He built one of the biggest hydroelectrical dams in the world, which is in Egypt, the Aswan Dam. And he also, you know, he did a lot to fight against illiteracy and had a lot of social programs. And I think the public university system in Egypt is very much the legacy of Abdel Nasser. So you could look at it in that sense also. But you also have to remember that in Egypt now we do have at this point a military government. And that military government, as much as the military has changed, as much as they are closer to Saudi Arabia and they're no longer really playing the populist role that they played back in the 1950s, they are still, you know, a military government. And Obama's presidency, you know, he presided over the Egyptian revolution, the overthrow of Hosni Mubarak. And that led to the civilian election, a democratic civilian election of Mohamed Morsi. From the Muslim Brotherhood. And now that civilian elected leader, Mohamed Morsi, has been toppled, and we have al-Sisi and the military back in power. So you can read into it in terms of local politics, but I think overall, you know, the fact that this hatred for Saudi, this hatred for Iran, that's very much a Saudi-aligned statement. Saudi Arabia sees the Islamic Republic of Iran as its greatest threat. That's why after the Iranian Revolution of 1979, we actually had the Reagan administration come out and announce to the world that they would never allow a revolution to take place in Saudi Arabia. We saw just a brutal crushing of the Shiite Muslim community in Saudi Arabia. On many occasions, Shia Muslims in Saudi Arabia have gone out to protest, to demand their right to just practice routine religious services. And I mean, it's been described as religious apartheid in Saudi Arabia, those who practice the form of Islam that is dominant in Iran. And you know, that rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia is pretty solid. And so for him to go to Cairo, Egypt, where there is a military government that is very friendly to Saudi Arabia in power, and for him to give a speech there, you know, just condemning Iran and condemning his predecessor for being friendly to Iran, that was a pretty solid statement, in support of Saudi Arabia more than anything else.
Well, first of all, let me say, I mean, Pompeo used some incredibly powerful language. American shame is over. That to me is just so I know Pompeo's not a president, but he's representing the United States. That's so contradictory to what you would expect the respect of the office of the presidency, no matter who the president is. But let me ask you quickly, where does Israel factor into all of this?
Well, that's very interesting. So first of all, Israel has been pushing the anti-Iran stuff for quite a while now. Iran is their main focus. The Netanyahu wing of Israeli politics is obsessed with Iran. And that's very clear. I mean, we saw Netanyahu actually brought to Congress to give a speech against Obama and against the Iran deal in Congress. I mean, a foreign president brought to the country in order to give a speech against the sitting president, something that, you know, probably wouldn't ever go on in another country. It was pretty big, and that's important to note. And what also is interesting about this is if one looks at the way politics has developed in the Middle East, no matter where you go in the Middle East, there is anger and just real anger at the Israelis for what they have done to the Palestinians. And Israel is just kind of hated in almost all Muslim countries around the world. However, there is a divide about whether or not the United States is hated. And, you know, during the 1970s, the 1960s, when the rise of Ba'athist Arab socialism was taking place, when you had the Islamic Revolution in 1979, a lot of those forces, that they argued that the United States was just as complicit, and that the United States was, Khomeini in Iran referred to the United States as the great Satan. He said that Israel was the little Satan that worked for the great Satan, the United States. Whereas the Saudis would talk against Israel, but they said the United States is fine. There's just this corrupt Israel lobby. that has too much influence and has a lot of power, and they're just manipulating the United States. The USA is a great country. We love to sell them oil and buy weapons from them and do business with them. And that has been the attitude generally of most of the absolute monarchies in the Middle East. While their media is very, very critical of Israel, it seems to pretend that the United States is just a completely benevolent power, that maybe it's been hoodwinked a little bit into supporting Israel, but that's not the case. And that is interesting, and that points toward an overall division, because for Pompeo to speak in Egypt, in a country where the United States has meddled in their politics extensively, and to essentially attack Obama for apologizing. What Obama did in his speech in Cairo was he apologized for the removal of Mossadegh, the democratically elected mm-hmm. leader of Iran. And he apologized for that coup. And Pompeo was essentially calling out Obama for doing that, saying, do not apologize for it. So this has, you know, that kind of rhetoric he's taking aside in Middle Eastern politics. But he's also again, taking aside in American politics. And this old divide, is it peace through strength or is it soft power and consolation? How do you run the global system of monopoly capitalism where big banks and corporations based in the United States and Britain dominate the world? Do you do it in a soft, friendly kind of way where you look really nice up front, but you maneuver in the back room with soft power and selling weapons and using proxy fighters? Or do you do it in a direct, violent, peace through strength, blow things up kind of way? How do you do it? And the military corporations and manufacturers that are a huge lobby in the United States and a huge sector of the U.S. economy, they very much favor peace through strength. And the intelligence community, which is a huge apparatus tied in with all kinds of interests and all kinds of contractors and has a lot of influence, especially in Silicon Valley, they tend to favor it another way. So this divide seems to play itself out, but ultimately the goal is the same, right? The goal is to defeat, you know, rising independent governments and economies around the world and maintain the rule of Western monopoly capital. But the question is, how do you go about doing that? Do you just straight up threaten Iran and try to blow it up and threaten regime change? Or do you make a deal and you know, sink your fingers in there and get American businesses tied in there and kind of get the American propaganda in there and gradually erode the revolutionary principles and create a political crisis? Do you do what was done to Libya, or do you do what was done to Iraq? Bush directly invaded Iraq, toppled them, right? Obama was able to kind of, you know, establish friendly relations with Libya, do business with them, you know, get American influence in there, create a political crisis, and ultimately topple the government of Gaddafi. Which tactic do you use? Do you do it the Mr. Nice Guy way, or do you do it the violent, hard-nosed way? That's the question.
But at the end of the day, the result is the same. American foreign policy is American foreign policy. Caleb Maupin, as always, man, thank you so much for your time, especially on such short notice. Greatly, greatly appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks, man. Thank you. All right, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. The United States today refused to recognize Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro's legitimacy as he starts a new term and urged rank-and-file government employees to empower the opposition. You know, for a country who is complaining about outside interference in its elections, this sure sounds hypocritical and dangerous to me. Why is the United States taking such a position? Well, for insight, we turn to my next guest. He's a human rights defender whose experience spans 4 decades of domestic and international education and activism. He's a veteran grassroots organizer whose roots are in the Black Liberation Movement, anti-apartheid and Central American solidarity struggles. He was Jill Stein's vice presidential running mate in the 2016 election. He is Brother Ajamu Baraka. Greetings. Welcome, as always. Thanks for coming to the Critical Hour.
It is my absolute pleasure to be with you.
You know, I read this story not only about Pompeo's statements, but also Bolton's tweets Bolton tweeted, "We will continue to increase pressure on the corrupt regime, support the Democratic National Assembly, and call for democracy and freedom in Venezuela." Pompeo called on Venezuelans to work not with Maduro, but with the National Assembly, which is controlled by the opposition but has been sidelined by a new constituent assembly created by Maduro's government. In my opening, I said, A, it's hypocritical, and B, dangerous. Am I overstating this?
No, you left one additional word out, and that is arrogant.
Okay.
It is incredible that U.S. authorities would make those kinds of comments, especially in light of the universally recognized failed democracy of this country. That basically, for example, we have a so-called democracy in which an individual can win the highest office in the land, but yet lose the popular vote. We have a democracy in which only half of the eligible citizenry will participate in this hollowed out process. But yet they feel comfortable not only commenting on democratic processes in other countries, but directly interfering in those internal affairs. So, you know, it is what you laid out was absolutely correct. This notion of the U.S. having a right and a responsibility to be able to influence the internal affairs of other countries and to criticize their processes based on the notion that they represent something that's called democracy is absolutely obscene.
Explain for my audience what it means for Pompeo to call on Venezuelans to work with the National Assembly.
What it means is that they are setting up a situation, a scenario, in which there will be a return to the kind of political destabilization, violence that we saw in the run-up to the election last year. It is a call really for the so-called opposition to begin to engage in anti-democratic activities once again in that country, including the levels of violence that we saw, including people being burnt to death, the blockades, and all of the anti-democratic activities that made Venezuela such a dangerous place to be for people who were, in fact, supporting democracy and trying to advance a new kind of society. So this is really a signal that the U.S. is prepared to support more intensified destabilization activities in that country.
President Maduro was sworn in for a second 6-year term. He's dealing with skyrocketing inflation. He's dealing with shortages of food and medicine. He's dealing with Venezuelans leaving the country. But if I understand the dynamics, the international dynamics, a lot of the problems that President Maduro is facing are really not due to his own creation, they're due to pressures being put upon Venezuela by the United States. Is that correct?
It is absolutely correct. That basically, as a consequence of the systematic economic destabilization, the Venezuelan economy is in the situation that it is in today. That by targeting certain individuals, by encouraging the hoarding of commodities to create the shortages in the country, by undermining the currency of the country, they have created the conditions that have led to people feeling compelled to leave their country in order to try to find a way to survive. It is a classic response by the U.S. state. We've seen it happen in Zimbabwe. We saw it happen in a number of different environments around the world where the U.S. will use its enormous economic power to undermine an economy, working with economic elites in those particular countries. So this notion that the Venezuela economy is facing what it's facing as a consequence of its own internal incompetence is an ideological position. It has no relationship to the objective reality of the country being in the crosshairs of U.S. destabilization.
And what's really behind the United States' interest in destabilizing Venezuela? Is it too simplistic to say that it's a socialist government and that the United States just cannot fathom a successful socialist government on the planet?
Venezuela was the nation that was in the forefront of significant political and economic changes in Latin America. When it was in a position to provide support to various left-leaning experiments, governments across the continent, it did that, and it was in the cutting edge of real significant change in Latin America as a consequence of the economy now being undermined by the U.S. Most of the progressive experiments in Latin America have also seen a significant reversal. So the U.S. Authorities understood that if they can undermine Venezuela, then they could turn back the progress that was being made throughout Latin America. So that's why they became in the crosshairs of U.S. destabilization, not just under Trump, but under the last two previous presidents, both mm-hmm. Obama and George W. Bush.
Elaborate a little bit on the Obama side of this equation, because there are so many people in the country that view President Obama as being this incredibly progressive, liberating-minded individual. But as Amiri Baraka said to me at one point, he said, Wilmer, you got to understand that whether you're talking about Barack Obama or you're talking about any other member of the administration, whether you're any administration, Condoleezza Rice or anybody, you're talking about functionaries of the United States government. And so that he's there to carry on the policy of empire. And that what you think of him personally, how nice he may be as an individual, has absolutely nothing to do with the policy platform that is implemented by an American president.
Well, my namesake is absolutely correct. That basically, that is the role of the executive of the U.S. state. So it doesn't really matter who is sitting in that office. They are there because they've been selected. And their responsibility is to advance the interests of the U.S. Capitalist class. So the concern with Venezuela and the targeting of Venezuela, even by the Obama administration, was consistent with U.S. policies. This notion that Obama was some kind of liberating force is basically a myth. In the first few months of Obama's administration, they had a chance to demonstrate where they stood in terms of progressive political change with Honduras. And what they decided was that they were going to give the green light to an anti-democratic coup in that country. The same thing happened with Egypt. The same thing happened when they turned their back on the pro-democracy movement in Bahrain. The same thing happened when they decided to invade and to destroy Libya. Obama was carrying out U.S. policy. So their declaration under the Obama administration that Venezuela represented a national security threat was in fact consistent. And the Trump administration has taken up that policy decision and have continued to carry out policies to undermine Venezuela, because to undermine Venezuela is to undermine progressive politics throughout Latin America.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are talking to Ajamu Baraka and getting his insight on both Mike Pompeo as well as John Bolton's comments calling into question the legitimacy of Venezuelan President Maduro. What role does oil and resources play into the United States' attack on Venezuela?
Of course, that's the second. That's the other part of the equation. That not only does Venezuela represent progressive politics in Latin America, they're able to represent progressive politics and to advance progressive politics because they had economic power. That economic power they had came from the fact that they were sitting on top of the largest reserve of oil on the planet. So the idea or the possibility that the U.S. could not only reverse the politics of Latin America by undermining Venezuela, but could put into office forces internal to Venezuela that would be more favorable to the U.S., giving the U.S. A more direct opportunity to control that oil, of course, is a very compelling economic motivation for destabilizing that country. So it's all about the politics, but even more importantly, in many cases, it's about following the money.
As we look at, if we could move to another country quickly, Brazil, and what the United States has been doing as it relates to the election, or what America did with the election in terms of Brazil, do we see America trying to install in Venezuela a similarly minded individual that has now been sworn in Brazil?
That is the objective. The objective was to turn back the left governments throughout Latin America. Not only did the Obama administration give a green light to a coup in Honduras, they also gave the green light to the constitutional coup that took place in Brazil that set up the conditions that led to the election of Bolsonaro in Brazil. So the entire trajectory of politics in Latin America has moved back toward the right as a consequence of the policies of both the Obama and now the Trump administration. We see the same things happening in Colombia, for example. So there's been a rightist reversal in Latin America, and that's part of the objective of U.S. politics to basically ensure that there are no positive examples of progressive development outside of the imaginations of people who are thinking beyond capitalism. So basically, Venezuela becomes an enemy in that sense.
Is it a coincidence that Steve Bannon played a role in Bolsonaro's victory? And is it too conspiratorial to say that it's beyond Steve Bannon, that if we look at him, that we're really missing the forest for the trees?
I think that you're absolutely right. I think that what we have to look at are the internal social and class forces in these particular cases. What I'm arguing is that the U.S. policy has aligned itself with the ruling classes in those various countries to effect a certain kind of politics, a politics that moves away from concerns with the working class and the poor, and more toward the supporting the neoliberal globalist project. I think that is the focus that we should look at. We know that Steve Bannon represents an even more extreme politics. There are going to be some limitations on Bolsonaro.
You say there are going to be some limitations on Bolsonaro?
There will be some limitations because
how so?
Of the agenda that he has to carry out is a neoliberal agenda. And therefore, the kind of extremist politics he may like to carry out will have some limitations, because I think that his masters back in D.C. understand that they don't want to create a situation in which there will be a popular uprising against against his regime.
Because the circumstances in Brazil are incredibly much more tenuous than I think most people here would understand. So your point, I mean, he has to walk a very, very, very fine line. It seems as though he and Trump came in on similar ideological rhetoric, but the realities underlying that rhetoric are much more tenuous in Brazil than here. Is that fair to say?
It's very fair because
if not using the word volatile,
very volatile because there is a more developed civil society in Brazil. There's a more grounded left politics, if you will, in Brazil, and therefore the possibility of intensified opposition is much more pronounced in Brazil than in the U.S.
And finally, we have just about a minute. I said in my opening that the U.S. tack towards Venezuela is dangerous, and you agreed. Where do you see the real danger lying?
In the U.S. continuing to undermine the country, but deciding that instead of just using economic means, it will go further and either directly intervene militarily or to try to enact a more violent coup through the military in that country, resulting in massive loss of life. I'm concerned about that in Venezuela, especially because we don't have much opposition to the Trump administration's efforts coming from progressive forces in the U.S. Therefore, they have almost a clear space to do what they want to do in Venezuela. And that's very, very dangerous.
Ajamu Baraka, as always, thank you so much for your time today. Greatly appreciate you coming and providing that invaluable insight to the Critical Hour.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.